No, no government co-op this week. It's not so text-based, but conceptual. And the topic for this week, as I said, is the halakhic status of DNA testing. We know that DNA testing is used in lots of legal ways in the civil system, and the question want to address or consider this evening is what halachic validity does it have? It's obviously got theoretical application in lots of areas. I thought of a number, three primary areas, each of which has various subdivisions. One is with regard to establishing paternity. It's a very big issue. Who's a person's father? You usually know who the mother is, but who's the person's father? This will have halakhic implications in a number of ways. The simplest area to discuss is in terms of inheritance. So a person dies and leaves an estate. And there's a question about who the children are. There's some, for some reason, there's uncertainty as to whether or not so and so is a child of the deceased. So a way to find that out would be by doing a DNA test. Another issue would be, in terms of kahuna, is a person a kohen? So sometimes there's uncertainty who the person's father is, and if it turns out it's not who you thought it was, then maybe you're not a kohen. Perhaps the biggest area in terms of establishing paternity being terms of personal status. Is a person a kasher Jew, or is there a person a mamzer? Mamzer's a person who's born to a married woman. Usually, it's the case where the person's born to a married woman, and the father is not the husband. There can be other ways that a person can be a mamzer as well. This is the most common scenario. And what happens if DNA testing shows up that somebody's father isn't actually their father? They say this is a big, big issue at Christmas time. Lots of people like to give in recent years these family relationship testing kits that you can sort of find out, take a swab and send it off and find out what your ancestry is, and that you're, 1/16th Irish and 1/48th Swedish or whatever it is. And sometimes people find a lot of interesting relatives. And that's lots of fun for them. And sometimes they find out that the people they always thought were their relatives actually aren't. And of course, it's not quite so much fun for them. Another area where DNA could be applied is in terms of establishing whether a person or whether a dead person, the identity of a dead person. This comes up from time to time. It's particularly a big issue 20 years ago, after the 9/11 attacks, but has been relevant on other occasions since, when the only way that you can identify a person is through DNA testing. That's going to be relevant in a number of areas. One area is going to be in terms of burial. So which grave should the person be buried in? Parts of bodies from different people. What should be buried with what? You could use DNA testing to identify what's what and who's who. But also in terms of remarriage, can the widow of the person presumed to have died, can they remarry or not? If we accept DNA evidence that a person has died, then his widow presumably would be able to remarry. If we don't, then they wouldn't be able to remarry. Also, in terms of sitting shiva and saying Kaddish and things like that, we want to know if a particular person died. We don't know, we're not 100% sure if it's this person. With DNA testing, perhaps we can identify who it is. Another area where it could have halakhic relevance, perhaps not so much in the modern era, but certainly in principle, is in terms of establishing a person's presence at a particular site. So we know that DNA profiling is used in the criminal system, you know, in this country, in terms of there's evidence of a person that has left their DNA at a crime scene. So then that obviously won't tell us that Plony Almoni did it, but it will tell us that Plony Almoni was there, and it's certainly circumstantial evidence. So, you know, these are the questions, you know, that we've got, really. Can we rely on DNA testing for these sorts of things? Predictably, it's a big discussion amongst the poskim. It's something of a machloket, and being a relatively new scientific development, certainly in halakhic terms, I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, the jury is still out on it in some you know, in some regards. We'll discuss the details of you know, the cases, you know, in just a moment, and you know what we need to consider. But you know, from the outset, you know, it's already, you know, anybody who's just listened to me, you know, establishing, you know, the types of scenarios that we could use DNA testing for, you know, should already flagged up the fact that in actual fact this is something of a double-edged sword. I see Tal's joined us this evening. Mazel tov, Tal, on your new daughter. You're probably very tired, so if you fancy dozing off, don't worry, we won't tell Judith. And I'll send you a crib sheaf afterwards in case she asks what was it all about. But Shetizku the Gadla, the Torah, the Chupa, the Masim Tovim. So big Mazel Tov, Tal. In any event, what's the double-edged sword here? Double-edged sword, you know, it sounds like really good. You know, you can have cases of Arguna where persons died or presumed to have died in, say, a terrorist attack or something like that, or a fire, some sort of tragedy like that. The widow, under normal circumstances, isn't able to remarry. We've got no evidence that her husband died. Bring out DNA testing and rely on that halakhically, and that solved a problem. That's really wonderful. On the other hand, if we're saying that DNA testing is good and reliable halakhically, then what's that going to say about a person we've always assumed is the son of Plony Almoni, and for whatever reason they have a DNA test done, and it shows that Plony Almoni is not the father? You know, so are we going to say, ah, oh, well, you know, that's DNA testing. DNA testing, we don't hold by it. Ah, but if we don't hold by DNA testing, then it's not going to solve our Arguna problem. If we're going to hold with it for the Arguna problem, then maybe it's going to cause problems with Mamzerim. So maybe it's a can of worms, if you like, that we don't really want to open up. And perhaps we might say it's best to leave sleeping dogs to lie. But those are, you know, that's a question that we've got at the very outset. As I say, it's very much a point of machloket. And, you know, a number of major poskim have written about it. I'm going to this evening relate to tshuva of Rav Osher Weiss on the subject in Sheilot and Tshuvot Minchat Asher in the third chelek, and also reference an important article or series of important articles by Rabbi J. David Bleich of Yeshiva University, which has appeared in the Tradition Journal over the course of the past couple of years. So the first question that we have to ask ourselves, of course, you know, do we have any precedents to suggest to us that we can bypass the normal halakhic mechanisms that are used and rely on scientific methods to establish halakhic criteria? For example, how do I usually establish, something in terms of Yerusha? How do I usually establish that somebody, that X is a valid heir to the estate of Y? So that's usually done on the basis of a chazaka. If we've got an assumption that Ploni Almoni is the son of his father, they've always presented themselves as father and son. The mother's always indicated that they are father and son. Everybody knows them as father and son. So that's a halachically valid way of identifying who the person is. Likewise with kahuna. If a person we know they come from a family of kohanim, they've always presented themselves as a kohen, they seem to be part of a family of kohanim, that's a chazaka that I've got. That should be, that should be the best way of, establishing that a person is a kohen. So, those are our normal ways of establishing something. How do I establish that a person has died? Well, usually I'll be able to see the body and identify it. And, with my own eyes, look at the person and see, they're dead. So I'll know that they're dead. How do I establish a person's presence at a crime scene? I'll use Edut. I'll have witnesses come and say that this is what's happened. So really we're asking, can we replace any of these mechanisms with a scientific method? So there are a couple of precedents for this. The most ancient is cited by a number of Rishonim. It's brought in the Sefer Chasidim in the name of Rav Sadia Gaon. There's a case cited where somebody, a person went off abroad, and he took with him his servant and left his pregnant wife back at home. Whilst he was away, he died, and his servant claimed the estate, claiming that he was actually the dead person's son and heir. But also, soon after the person had left the home shores, his wife gave birth to a son. And some years later, the son heard about his father and the estate and made a claim on the estate. And the question was, who is the legitimate heir to this dead person and the estate? As the servant claimed that he was actually a child of the deceased. Perhaps if the story had been hushed up somehow or other, it'd been with a single mother or whatever it was. But he was the son of the deceased. The child of the mother claimed that no, he was the sole child of the deceased. So the case came before Rav Sadia Gaon, and Rav Sadia Gaon apparently said, let's exhume a bone from the deceased, and let's have each of the claimants give a blood sample, and we're going to take the bone from the deceased and place it in each of the cups of blood and see if the bone absorbs the blood. And the assumption being that whichever blood the bone absorbed, that was a familial relationship there. If the bone didn't absorb any blood, then there was no blood relationship between the deceased and the person who'd given the blood. So we're not really interested for our purposes in how that works, whether it really did work, the scientific validity of such a procedure. Now, what we're interested in is the fact that Rav Sadia Gaon seemed to be willing to recognise that as a way of establishing paternity for purposes, at least for purposes of Yerusha. So that's one smach that we have, it's not necessarily a cast iron proof of anything. We don't know really the details of the circumstances exactly, you know, what happened with Rav Sadia Gaon and why he was doing this and why he felt he could rely on it and what he was trying to prove. But it does suggest to us that there might be grounds to rely on scientific evidence. That's number one. Number two, a point which has been discussed perhaps for the past 50 odd years, 50, 60, maybe 70 years, is the question of the halakhic validity of blood tests. Blood tests can also indicate paternity. Are these halakhically valid or not? It seems this is a machloket. This was a machloket of the poskim. A generation or two ago, many of the poskim were of the opinion that we're not going to take any halachic notice of blood tests. Yeah, they might be scientifically correct, but they're not relevant to the halachic. They're not relevant to the halachic process. That's one school of thought, and for a variety of reasons, some of the poskim felt that they weren't necessarily reliable enough. They had a high level of reliability, but they weren't watertight. And if they weren't watertight, then we can't rely on them. Others felt that they just didn't fit into any of the halachic models that we have, and that halachic status is defined by halachic models. And therefore, we're interested really in a halachic status rather than necessarily being interested in a physical reality, which is, of course, an interesting notion, right? In terms of, you know, the suggestion is that I might know through DNA or through blood test that Mr. Goldberg is not the father of young Chaim Goldberg. I hope there's nobody with Chaim Goldberg as a first cousin on this Zoom call this evening, or even a second cousin for that matter. In any event, I might know that Mr. Goldberg is not the father. Maybe DNA testing has told me that. It's conceivable to say that person's still not a mumzer, because the status of mumzerut is given not through scientific knowledge, but through normative halachic models. That's certainly a position that one could maintain. So there were some poskim who just didn't want to get involved in blood tests, saying that, you know, they just didn't fit any of the normative models that we have. On the other hand, Rav Herzog was the first chief rabbi of Medinat Yisrael in the pre-state era, and then in the 1950s, he was of the opinion that no, you follow scientific evidence. If something is generally accepted as being valid in the scientific world, so then we'll accept it in the halachic world as well as an indicator of reality. There are also those who said that the reason why we don't want to follow scientific evidence is because scientific evidence is always subject to change. Any scientist, they say, will tell you that, you know, what I'm telling you now is, you know, we believe it to be absolutely true, but there's always changes in scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge changes and advances, and, you know, that we can't preclude that something else, you know, will supersede this at some stage in the future. So in terms of blood tests, there was a certain amount of halakhic discussion. Now, in terms of DNA, again, there's some discussion about it. Rav Avadia Yosef, for example, was of the opinion that no, we're going to apply the same rules as applied to blood tests. Doesn't really, you know, that halakha doesn't recognize blood tests. We're not going to recognize DNA either. On the other hand, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was of the opinion that this is something which is scientifically accepted, Therefore, it's going to have halachic tokef, halachic validity as well, and we can use it in all these examples that I've given to you. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, a son-in-law of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and a distinguished posek in Yerushalayim, passed away just a couple of years ago. He was of the opinion that DNA evidence is just as good as fingerprint evidence, and fingerprint evidence is accepted in halakha, for lots of things. Its DNA is better than blood tests. Not everybody agrees with this. Rabbi J. David Blythe, for example, was not of that opinion. He felt that, in actual fact, blood tests were halachically better than DNA testing, and that we shouldn't say that that we can necessarily rely on DNA. He doesn't necessarily accept fingerprinting either. And, he makes the observation that DNA testing has never yet shown to be fallible. We've never yet seen that any but two people have the same DNA unless they're identical twins. But that doesn't necessarily prove to us that it couldn't be the case. And, it's got a reliability rate of 99.whatever%, but it's not a reliability rate of 100%. And maybe that's relevant. Anyhow, let's think now a little bit about the considerations of Rav Osher Weiss, and then we'll come on to some other considerations as well. So Rav Osher Weiss has a very, very fascinating tshuva. And he says, really, in different halachic spheres, we have different halachic requirements. So, for example, if I want to say that Ploni Almoni is guilty of a murder, right, then I have to have edus about this. I have to have witness testimony about it. Even though witness testimony, of course, is not always infallible. Sometimes it's fallible and witnesses can lie. But nevertheless, what I need is witness testimony. And he cites the Gemara, which talks about a person, an Amora, who saw a certain person, A, chasing B, and A had a knife in his hand, and B was running away from him, shrying a gewalt at the top of his voice. He chased after them. He chased them into a cul-de-sac, into a churba, into some ruin there, with no escape route. He found B lying on the floor in a pool of blood with the knife stuck into him, and A covered in blood. And he said, we're not able to be mechayev this person mita. We're not allowed to put this person to death for murder because we don't have witness evidence that A killed B. We've got circumstantial evidence. We can't think of any other way that this could have happened, but we don't have the necessary edut that's required here. So there are certain cases where edut is required. If edut is required, then DNA evidence is not going to be able to replace that. That's the view of Rav Osher Weiss. He then goes on to discuss cases where what's required is an umdana. There are certain cases where you don't need edut. You need circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is good enough. So, for example, as far as that's concerned, that might be with regard to inheritance. Do we assume that A is the son of B? So, we've got an umdana. We've got circumstantial evidence and a chazakah that's the case. DNA evidence, how will that fit into it? It might work as an umdana. It might be good enough. It might be good enough circumstantial evidence in the absence of any other evidence. In terms of, if I've got, nobody contesting a will, just somebody, coming saying, this is, they are entitled to it, and we're not certain about it because that person hasn't previously presented themselves as an heir, but there's nobody else contesting that will. There's nobody else presenting them as an heir. Otherwise, this person, you know, has died without any heirs. So, you know, maybe this would be good enough. On the other hand, if we've got competing claims, then maybe this wouldn't be good enough because the other claim is a chazaka. One of the parties said, listen, you know, I've been known as so-and-so's only son for 25 years. Now somebody else has shown up and claiming that they're a son. They might have DNA evidence to present, which is, you know, which is quite good. But my chazaka is stronger. So sometimes we're going to have the question, you know, what is the stronger evidence that we've got here? You know, you might have a case where we simply want to know is so and so a child of their presumed father? Perhaps it's use of kibbud avim. The person wants to know, do they have a mitzvah of kibbud avim? And for example, you know, for whatever reason, they've got grounds to be suspicious that they might not be the son of that person. So ignore mamzerut. There's no mamzerut issues. You know, they were born out of wedlock. They're not worried about mamzerut. You know, that would be a question. If there's nothing competing, you know, with what they're trying to establish, then it seems that we probably would accept DNA evidence in that regard. What about in terms of establishing the death of a person? So these were big cases. You know, a number of you know, there were a number of aguna, potential aguna cases in the aftermath of 9/11. And all of those aguna cases were actually resolved in a positive way to allow the widows to remarry. Rav Osher Weiss makes the observation that in terms of identifying a corpse, we have a notion of what we call simanim. Okay, sometimes, you know, the Gemara talks about, you know, a person's died. And, you know, the body's not easily identifiable. But in certain ways, it is identifiable. That you've got what we call simanim. That's, you know, one of a siman nowadays would be, you know, perhaps medical, dental records. You know, but it could be that, you know, the person, you know, the person has died. You can't recognize the face, but you can see they've got a birthmark that's known about on the shoulder, a birthmark on the elbow, and a circle of freckles, you know, on their chest. All right, so those are simanim. That would indicate to us that this person has died, and we would allow the widow to remarry. And he says that DNA evidence is going to be at least as good as simanim. It's as good as simanim, it's as good as any other identifying mark, and therefore it could be used to permit remarriage. Apparently, DNA evidence was used as a consideration with regards to the Agunot from 9/11. It wasn't the only consideration. So I believe that none of the Agunot were permitted to remarry solely on the basis of DNA evidence, but they combine that with other considerations, which again, each by themselves wasn't sufficient to allow the widows to remarry, but taken as a package, they did allow the widows to remarry. So what we're seeing here is that Rav Osher Weiss is very favourably inclined towards acceptance of DNA evidence in terms of establishing who's entitled to receive an inheritance, in terms of allowing remarriage if a person, you know, to establish that a person has died, that his widow can remarry. Also, he's applied, you know, in terms of, you know, parental responsibility, having to pay child maintenance and that sort of thing. Rav Osher Weiss accepts it as being quite definitive. So then we've got the question about what about mamzerut? Does that mean to say if DNA evidence shows up that a person is a mamzer, that that's now going to establish that they're a mamzer? You can imagine a case. You can have a case where a woman had an affair, and conceived a child, and presumes that that child is actually not her husband's child. But the husband never gets wind of it, and nobody ever says anything, and the child is always brought up as the husband's child. The child believes it's the husband's child. The husband believes it's his child. Perhaps even the person she had an affair with believes that it was the husband's child. 10 years, 20 years down the line, she has a falling out with her husband, and the couple divorce. And it's an acrimonious situation. And she says that, you know, that the child's not even your child. You know, so he said, what? What do you mean it's not my child? She said, 20 years ago, I had an affair with so-and-so. That's the first the husband knows of it. This is the first the child knows of it. And in order to spite her ex-husband or to prove a point or whatever it is, or to disinherit her son or whatever it might be, she has DNA testing done and proves that it's not the husband's child. So, you know, the child wasn't involved in these discussions at all. Never submitted, you know, for DNA, never, you know, agreed to DNA testing, never said he was happy to have it done. You know, she took a hair out of his head while he was asleep or something like that, or submitted his toothbrush, something like that. Rav Osher Weiss has indicated to us till now that DNA evidence is very compelling in a halachic sense. And even though he might say that, well, you know, Mamzerut is much more serious than the other issues, at least it should create some sort of safek. At least we should say, well, this person might not be a Vadai Mamzer. This person is a safek Mamzer. I'm worried that he could be a Mamzer. Can you upset the apple cart in such a way? So Rav Osher Weiss has a very, very fascinating approach to this question. And it's clear what's motivating his approach. His conclusion is going to be that we don't accept the DNA evidence. Now, why is it going to be that we don't accept the DNA evidence for Mamzerut, but we do for other things? Now, the first point to observe is that there's a background to this. The background is that, of course, Rav Osher Weiss doesn't want to create a situation whereby people who've lived all their lives with a chazakah of kashrut all of a sudden are going to find out they're mamzerim because of DNA testing. That's not a situation that we want. Of course, we want the religious purity of Am Yisrael, but we also don't want to turn lives up and upside down like this. And therefore, he says, no, we can't rely on scientific evidence. We can't rely on scientific evidence for mamzerut. So I see a few people raising their eyebrows and pulling faces. Not simultaneously necessary, because then they look quite strange. But how can he say on the one hand we do accept DNA and on the other hand we don't? On the one hand we accept scientific evidence and on the other hand we don't. So he says, oh, of course we accept scientific evidence. That is the Marshall's various proofs to show that, you know, the way the halakha works is that whatever is commonly accepted in the scientific world has halachic validity. But he says that's with a caveat. That's with the caveat that it applies to things that apply are applicable now, but it doesn't apply to things which are going to be applicable in the future. Meaning that we know scientifically that scientific knowledge can change and progress and advance, but we've got what we've got. You know, it might be in some stage in the future, somebody will prove that apples don't really fall from the tree and that Newton got it wrong and there was no, there's no gravity and whatever it might be. But for the time being, we're pretty much convinced that there is gravity and that Newton got it right and that this is valid scientific knowledge and that's got halachic relevance. But the status of being a mamzer doesn't just have relevance for today, it has relevance for the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. And when it comes to relying on scientific evidence, which might change, I don't know if this will change, but there's been lots of scientific progress over the course of the past 3,000 years, so it might change. I can't rely on something that might change for the future. I can, the halakhic system tells me I must rely on it for today. Today's halakhic scientific knowledge is something which I rely on for today, but it's not something that I can rely on for the future. So this is, I think, a very, very brave approach. Reflecting the braveness of Rav Osher Weiss in terms of what he's trying to do, in terms of he's trying to tick all of our boxes, accept DNA evidence where there's compelling logical reason to do so, but at the same time rejecting it and creating a halachic reasoning to reject it when it's going to cause problems that we don't want to be caused. I'm not suggesting that he's being disingenuous in any way. What I'm suggesting is that he's being creative and motivated by factors that I think we can all identify with. The truth is that Rav Osher Weiss wasn't the only one who made such distinctions. For example, Rabbi Willig, Rav Mordechai Willig of Yeshiva University, has addressed this. And he's made the observation that in different halachic areas, we have different halachic standards. So, for example, in terms of allowing an aguna to remarry, okay, then in general we have lower halachic standards. We say we don't need two witnesses, we just need one witness. We say that even though in general women aren't able to give eidut in a beit din, to allow a woman to remarry, we will accept the eidut of a woman. So in terms of, so whilst DNA testing evidence might not be the best type of eidut, but it's going to be good enough to allow a woman to remarry. But it's not going to be good enough to declare somebody to be a mamzer. That's one observation that he makes. A further observation that he makes is also that in many instances, not all instances, of course, but many instances, DNA evidence will only tell me that Mr. Goldberg is not Chaim's father. It won't necessarily tell me, it won't tell me who Chaim's father is. Unless, you know, if I suspect that Mr. Cohen is Chaim Goldberg's father and I test Mr. Cohen, so then that will tell me who the father is. In many cases, fine, it told me that the person I assumed is the father isn't the father, but it hasn't told me who the father is. So there could be a number of possibilities. The father could be non-Jewish. The father's non-Jewish, there's not a case of mamzerut here. The father, the pregnancy could have been done through IVF. If it's done through IVF, then according to many poskim, there's no issue there of mamzerut. And the third consideration that he makes is that we might say that we're going to accept DNA evidence to identify who a person is, but not to identify who their relatives are. In terms of, it's a difference, and I'm no scientist as far as this is concerned, but it seems to be much more straightforward, much more obvious to demonstrate that I've got this bit of hair, and the DNA on this hair tells me that this hair comes from Mr. Goldberg, who's lying dead in front of me, or this body that's lying dead in front of me. I know this is Mr. Goldberg's hair, and it matches the body lying in front of me. That tells me that body is Mr. Goldberg. But to identify Mr. Goldberg as being Chaim Goldberg's father, that's a different relationship between the DNAs. We're looking for similarities rather than for it being identical. And as far as that's concerned, perhaps we won't accept the DNA because it's more DNA evidence, because it's more complex. Another consideration given is that bend off. Another consideration that the Poskim, you know, suggests for not accepting DNA evidence in terms of mum's erut is to say that, you know, DNA essentially has the halachic status of a rov. Yeah, you know, majority, you know, most cases where, you know, DNA evidence points to whatever, the overwhelming majority of those cases, it's going to be true. I've also got a rov in the case of mum's erut. I've got, that most of the halakha says, the Gemara says, rov bilot achar habal, that usually we can assume that a child is the child of the husband rather than anybody else, because a woman is usually intimate more often with her husband than she is with anybody else. Therefore, statistically, it's most likely to be the husband's child. Statistically, DNA is telling us it's not the husband's child. We've got a tension now between two rovs. What are we going to follow? They say, hold on a minute. We've got a notion of chazaka. This child has a chazaka, has a presumption of being the child of the father. So I've got two rovs which are cancelling each other out. Then I don't know where I am. You know, I can't say anything. But I've got a chazaka. So the details of that aren't so important. What's particularly interesting is the fact that there are a number of major poskim who want to be able to accept DNA evidence in some halachic contexts and reject it in other halachic contexts, and they're willing to create halachic differences between those two contexts in order to allow its permissibility sometimes and to disallow its legitimacy in other contexts. And I think this, showcases for us that even though, we often like to say that, the halakha is, independent of ethical and moral and emotional considerations, what we're seeing is that's not actually true. And, again, Poskim discuss, should a person, have DNA tests? What if a person, person suddenly sort of has a hunch that maybe they're a mamzer? Person's about to get married, and they have a hunch from some whispered conversations that they've overheard that maybe there's some doubt about their lineage. So this person's very worried. They're a Yirei Shamayim, and they say to themselves, hold on, if I'm a mamzer, I'm not allowed to marry this person. So they think, I'm a God-fearing Jew, I don't want to marry somebody that I shouldn't marry. Maybe they should go and have a DNA test just to confirm that in actual fact they are the child of their father. Rav Eliashiv was the opinion, don't bother having the DNA test. You don't need to have it. Better not to have it. That seems to indicate that he would have been worried if they had had it, that he might have given some credence to the results. But certainly indicated that, it's better we don't know. So we've got no halachic grounds to be concerned at the moment. So stick with that. Don't create a problem there. Certainly from reading Ralph Bleich's lengthy articles on the subject, it seems that he's very hesitant about accepting DNA evidence on lots of halachic grounds, combined with the fact that he doesn't feel that it's that it's watertight enough to be accepted in the halachic system, and other considerations that he's got as well. Will be interesting to see if in the course of coming generations and coming decades, as to whether or not it will be regarded as more and more normative in halachic halachic areas. That would be an interesting question. As I say, it's still somewhat in its infancy, certainly from a halachic perspective. But it is interesting how essentially a lot of poskim have wanted to adopt it and accept it, at least in certain realms, and then you're left with the question, if we accept it in some realms, you know, some Poskim do seem to be of the opinion that, you know, if you accept it for evidence of a death to allow Narguna to remarry, then you're going to have to accept it in terms of Mamzerut as well. But it seems that the Poskim are trying to shy away from that, which I think is particularly interesting. So those were really the thoughts